However, we start tonight with an item that I'm very interested in and very delighted to have my guest sitting opposite me. The late Mihal Osulwan is widely regarded as one of the most talented academics, pianists and composers of his era. And on Friday evening, the National Concert Hall will honour him with its 2022 Lifetime Achievement Award, recognising the significant impact and contribution Mihal made on the musical life of Ireland over the course of his career. The award will be presented to Mihal's family at the National Concert Hall on Friday, when the National Symphony Orchestra, in collaboration with the University of Limerick, pays tribute to Mihal Osulwan with a concert of music entitled Lumen, a celebration of light. And the guest that I mentioned and delighted to have sitting opposite me is the conductor for the concert, David Brophy. Lovely to have you with us this evening, David. And you know, your association not only with Mihal Osulwan but with this particular set of concerts goes back a bit. This is part of a trilogy that in fact Mihal had planned. So explain what was planned across the three concerts.
Well, I think Mihal got to the point where maybe the academic side of what he had been involved in for so many years, particularly with the University of Limerick, had started to quiet down a little bit. So I think he'd reached a point in his life, maybe in the couple of years before he died, where he was both looking back and looking forward. And I think it was a tantalising time for me as a collaborator, but also for a lot of musicians who worked with him, because he was breaking new ground just in the run-up to when he died, but also he was looking back on stuff. And these concerts were a little bit about looking back, but also looking forward as well.
Yeah, but even when you look at the titles of the concerts, I gave the title of the third in the trilogy, Lumen, a celebration of light. But the titles for the other two, Elver Gleams and Between Worlds from 2017 and 2018, particularly Between Worlds, really describes Mihal Osulwan, doesn't it? Between not just two worlds, several worlds.
Yeah, and it's kind of easy to just kind of say he took in classical and traditional idioms, but it's far more than that. You know, he was a sponge who took so many influences, including from jazz, but and all sorts of influences as well. And I think the gift of Mihal is that he could take all the influences from all the various styles of music and synthesize them in some way into his own, make it a voice, but without it feeling like, you know, if you listen to things like Aoife Nollaig and it starts with those innocuous A's, octaves in the piano, you know, like, and it could be anything, and it goes into jazz and then it goes into trad. And then you've got a sax solo, and you've got he plays stride piano at one stage. And at the end, you've got this, you know, that could be like 1970s, 80s jazz show music, you know. And it all seems utterly natural. And I think Mihal was the only person who could write that music.
Well, funny enough, I was listening back today to a concert that you conducted yourself in UL when Mihal was retiring from his position.
I remember the concert well.
Brilliant concert. And it's on the Lyric website. Well, worth going back and seeking out. They repeated it again in March of last year, or March after the concert went out live. However, I diverge. Now, this is from that concert. Mihal's introduction to this piece was, he said, "This is an exercise in rhythmic concentration." Now, if a music professor said that to you, you'd think, "Oh Lord, I'm an exercise in rhythmic concentration. I'm going to be bored out of me tree for the next 5 or 10 minutes trying to count in fives, sevens, elevens and whatever." Yeah. Let's listen to what the piece that he was talking about sounded like.
Thank you.
So there you go. That's just a little taste of Must Be More Crispy. That was the RTE Concert Orchestra, David Brophy conducting a concert from November 2016. Actually, that was, it seems like it was yesterday, in fact, and then repeated, the, as I said, the St. Patrick's Night the year after in on RTE Lyric FM. But you were, as you were listening to that, David, you were recognising all kinds of musical influences.
Well, that opening idea, the scale goes up and then it comes down again. Then he does what Stravinsky did 100 years before him, which is take two notes out and then do it again, and then add three notes in and do it again, and then add four notes in. And it just shifts all the time. Mm. And it's the shift that makes it interesting. And it doesn't feel like you're being... in one way it's academic, but in other ways, yeah, it's absolutely immediate. And that was his gift. That notions of high and low art went out the window. It was all one thing. We're all working with the same number of notes. And then he has this little beautiful little sequential writing when he plays the piano. It's repeated notes coming down and chords going down a fourth, up a fifth, or down a fifth, up a fourth. Just repeating back and forth. And then he's... That's Baroque music straight away. Yeah. You can just feel it all of a sudden. And then we're back to... And these notions of... It's you know, it's the old and the new. And it all comes together in one stream of consciousness that could at once be improvised... But actually, we've rehearsed and it's all written down. It's like, yeah, and we make it sound like normal. It's amazing.
And I suppose it is worth and important to mention that, and he said this himself, because Micheál introduced a lot of the music, yes, on the night at that concert, and he recognised here that it was co-composed with Mel Mercier.
With Mel, you can hear him playing Bones in the background. There.
Is he part of the concert?
Mel will be with us on Friday night and with us on Saturday as well. I'm great looking forward to seeing him again.
And again, he mentions, I think it was Micheál who mentions the specifics of the reality that part of that was from Indian rhythms. But again, that could be arid academic in other hands. It just isn't like that.
It's kind of amazing because we maybe foolishly or erroneous call music an international language, but there's so many different dialects. Mm. And Micheál could cut through the dialects. Irish, as you say, Indian, Eastern, Arabian music, any sort of music you think of, he could take it and synthesize it into one simple, pure language in which you weren't aware that the dialect was coming from elsewhere in the world. It was immediately happening now. And he, in a weird way, he made everything sound Irish.
Yeah.
And there was a global... Micheál was both local and global. And he was parochial and he was international at the same time. That's a rare gift.
Well, let me take something then that I think speaks directly to that, because I'm not sure which piece we'd go to second, but I think this is actually going to be the first piece that you're playing on the night, Templum.
Templum, yeah.
So, it's a very different Micheál O'Sullivan one in many ways from the Must Be More Crispy, which has those lovely rhythms that we associate with them.
I think it's very gutsy because as a composer, there's so many composers who feel their job is to compose, to act, to write, and to write things down. But Micheál had like real great guts to write very simple music at times. And because the classical musicians are used, classical music is in many ways very complex and intricate, has lots of different lines moving. Mm. But Micheál was never afraid to give a classical musician something very, very simple that in other contexts might seem boring, but in the context that he wrote it and he composed it in, was absolutely perfect.
And the instrument that's given the task here is the soprano saxophone, and Kenneth Edge
against
performing.
Beautifully simple chords and the strings below underneath it, that's almost perfect.
Thank you. again, that's a Templum music of Micheál O'Sullivan, and it's the piece that in fact will open the concert that we're speaking about, which takes place on Friday night at the National Concert Hall and on Saturday night at the University Concert Hall in Limerick. Lumen, the music of Micheál O'Sullivan, a celebration of the light with the National Symphony Orchestra conducted by David Brophy on the evening. David with me in studio this evening. Again, as we were listening to that, I don't know many composers we named that we could hear in the midst of it all, David.
Well, you kind of think of Jan Garbarek, maybe at some, especially with the sax playing, you know, like that's kind of sound. But also, you know, you think of the string harmonies, which have superimposed fifths. It could be Aaron Copland, and it has that kind of wide open landscape to it as well. But the gift is that it's none of those people. It's purely Micheál, and it's never, his music's never derivative. I never thought that Micheál, it was pure Micheál, and it came directly from him, from the source. And it's Micheál was a great believer in the sense that, you know, in all, because he was an academic as well, you know, you could, in acquiring knowledge, it then became yours, you owned it, and then it went in a new direction and everything evolved. And so nothing that Micheál took in his influence never came out as anybody else. It always came out as Micheál, and that is a very rare gift, and you can hear it there. It could only be Micheál.
Yeah, but you also pointed out quite rightly, and I think it is Kenneth Edge who was playing there. Kenneth's playing, and he'll be playing with you on Friday as well, on soprano saxophone there. And Ken has both a classical and a jazz background, and Micheál O'Sullivan, you were mentioning, leaves room for that.
Micheál understood people in a way that maybe a lot of composers potentially don't. And he knows when he's got a performer who needs a bit of space in between the notes to maybe embellish or to have a bit of freedom in the phrase. So you can hear sometimes the strings and the voices there stop to let Ken and the saxophone soar a little bit and decorate a line and flourish, and then the strings come back in afterwards, and it makes absolute sense. It's like a conversation between the sax and the accompanying lower voices. It's really
and it also struck special. Me listening to some of the saxophone, the little ornaments that Ken is possibly improvising.
Yes.
Possibly some of them are written. I'm not quite sure, but there's a touch of a Chanos style ornament in there.
But that's Micheál as a giver. He's giving space, and in a way that other composers would write everything down. Micheál never did that. He did write things down, but he'd say, I remember to ask him questions, and it was the great times of Micheál was that he'd ask him questions about his score, and he kind of look at you kind of blankly, why are you asking that questions, you know? He'd say, just do it the way you do it, you know, like, and that's a rare gift of a composer who writes music and then gives it to you and expects you to do it, and doesn't necessarily have to have their claws or paws all over it. There's a great ownership in Micheál's music, but he gives it away immediately, and that's a great thing.
Obviously, the mixing of traditional music and traditional instruments with orchestra isn't always an easy thing. It is quite a challenging thing to do. None more so than with the voice itself and a Chanos style. I know we've had Myrna McCarley recently on the Roisin Reimagined thing, but Micheál was doing that type of thing before this as
this
well.
But I think this is where the new ground came from Micheál, because he was approached by Iarla Leonard to arrange some Chanos tunes for himself and orchestra. And Micheál found something new at this point, which I don't think any other Irish composer had done. He'd found a way of allowing Iarla have the space and the phrase, and he found a way of putting a pulse into the orchestra that didn't impose a pulse on the voice. And that, I don't even know how he did it. I remember the first time I conducted on Buach a Caoil Dubh in Studio One here in RTE, and having learned the score, not knowing how it would fit together, and realising after the first run of it, that just matched impeccably, and it was effortless, and I didn't have to work at all. And I looked at him and I didn't know how he did it. And Micheál, for people who saw him, he was such a huge presence of a man,
presence,
you know, big presence, those amazing piercing eyes, that great shock of silver hair slicked back, and he always stood really tall and proud. And there he is, and we've just done Buach a Caoil Dubh for the first time, and I turned to Iarla with my eyebrows very far above my eye and go, my God, how simple was that? But yet not simple, but yet complex, but yet simple, but yet complex. And that's Micheál. How he found that in between line, between the complexity and the simplicity, was, I think, for me, pure genius.
We listen to a little bit of Buach a Caoil Dubh. It was absolutely brilliant, not least because of the voice of Iarla O'Leonard, which comes straight from some other universe. And that is just extraordinary stuff. Éireann, the voice of Éireann Leonard there, and An Buachaill Caoilte of an arrangement with David Brophy with me in studio ahead of. That is one of the pieces you will be performing that's, on the concert yes, on Friday and Saturday, one, yeah. David, ahead of that concert. But we're listening to that, and I said, is that a didgeridoo that I'm hearing in the midst of all of that? That's a recording that features didgeridoo and electronics, you reckon?
Yeah, and it's that was I think that was probably recorded prior to Micheál writing the orchestral arrangement that we're going to play on Friday and Saturday.
So it's Micheál's own arrangements that you'll be using?
Yeah, and but it's Micheál, like you would see, kind of see a drone on the page with Micheál, and that, but there'd be something internal in the drone that, you know, he'd move a note somewhere, that he always had an internal rhythm in stuff that seems static.
Yes.
And I think that was, you hear, that's what you hear there.
Yeah, well, particularly with a Sean No song, which can have kind of feel as if there's no beat in it.
So and there is such a rhythm to Sean No's music, I think it's wrong to say that while, you know, there's, you don't necessarily tap your foot to what you've just heard there, there is an internal phrase and cadence and rhythm to what Éireann does, but you find it in his breath, and Micheál understood that, and that's years of him understanding that before he arranges
The other thing that strikes me is that, you know, you'll have not just one, but in one of the pieces, you have how many Sean No singers on stage with the soprano saxophone and the orchestra?
We will have three at one stage. So we'll have Éireann, we'll have the fantastic Sheila Denver, and we'll have the brilliant Lilla Soldera from Donegal. And I'm really looking forward to working with the three
and
of them.
Sopranos. And you've the piper, there's a tune for pipes as well. There's an arrangement of tunes for pipes. Amazing. It will be an emotional event in both cities, I would have thought, because Micheál's family will receive the award on his behalf, obviously, on Friday night at the National Concert Hall. And Limerick and Micheál O'Sullivan, I mean, the two things are so
I don't know how I feel about it, because I miss him so much, and I'm kind of looking forward to it, and I'm also a bit worried how I will, you know, can I hold it together, because he'll be such a presence, and he was such a presence, but it won't be the same without him. And even though he lives on through the music, I'm kind of, there's one part of me relishing performing the music and working with this great music again, but I don't know how I'm going to cope without him on Friday and Saturday night.
Well,
I have
sure
to say that
he'd probably tell you let the music at it, and hopefully that'll be the wave that you can ride on the
night. There was something also very matter of fact about Micheál, and that's how I'm going to approach Friday and Saturday night. So,
well, listen, they will be phenomenal concerts. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts about them, and indeed about the music of the wonderful Micheál O'Sullivan. Lumen, the music of Micheál O'Sullivan, Celebration of the Light, National Concert Hall, Dublin, Friday the 2nd of September, Saturday the 3rd of September at University Concert Hall, Limerick. The National Symphony Orchestra will be conducted on the night by David Brophy. Thanks very much for coming in to us, David.
Thanks, John.
Have you ever wondered what the stage can do that film simply cannot? Well, Pan Pan Theatre Company is about to answer that question as they move their series of short films, Mespel in the Dark, from the screen into the Samuel Beckett Theatre in Dublin. The project started out as a series of short films about the bohemian life of the actor, writer residence of the Mespel Flats in Dublin, but now Pan Pan is evolving that work to the stage and asking fundamental questions about the nature of theatre in the process. With me in studio this evening, actor Andrew Bennett and artistic director of Pan Pan Theatre, Gavin Quinn. I think it's true to say, Gavin, is it, that when you were conceiving Mespel in the Dark in the first place, it was kind of conceived as a dual entity, if you like. It had a double identity, both film and theatre.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, the idea was to first make short films to see that detail, to see how film works in a particular way, almost in a kind of a cinema verite, how we can get inside people's actual real apartments. But then we decided we would challenge ourselves to make a theatre show and look at what theatre can do differently and see, you know, where would we end up with the same subject.
And give us a sense of what the subject or who the subjects were, really, because it's the characters and the people of the Mespel Flats, the artistic community of that set of buildings.
Exactly.
That's at the heart of this.
Exactly. And it's there are fictional short films, but they're based on real people and they're based on the real actors who play the parts. So in this case, in the theatre show now, we have Robert O'Mahony, and his character is called Bill O'Malley, and we make him out to be an actor director, which Robert is an actor, but in this sense, for the stage show, he is trying to put on a play called Coup de Théâtre, and he puts a note up in the Mespel Flats asking for anyone who'd like to join in and be in his show. So it has that kind of comic element, but it also portrays the kind of, you know, the torture of putting on theatre shows. But in the actual films, then you've got all these different characters, like Alwyn Fouré plays Olive. Kareem, who's in the show, plays this character called Lance, who's a pharmacist, who's a musician, and Kareem is in the show. And then you've got Andrew Bennett, who plays Aidan, who's an actor who's kind of slightly given up, does mostly voiceovers, and then you see his character then in the theatre show.
Well, let's go to the actor who's slightly given up and does mostly voiceovers, as well as Oscar-nominated films, it must be said as well. We will come back to Aunt Colleen Kuhn's for sure before the end of this conversation, Andrew. But talk to me about that character, first of all, and your flat, which has starred on stage, has been on stage before.
Yeah, yeah. Again, with Pan Pan. Mm. And it is kind of extraordinary. You know, you are exposing yourself a little bit with that show where the company made a facsimile reproduction of my flat.
This was a show, I had to ask you to check the name of it with you, Everyone is King Lear in His Own Home.
Yeah.
Kind of had a vague King Lear
theme. Vague King Lear thing. Yeah, myself and Judith Roddy, sort of semi-Lear and Cordelia and the Fool a little bit. But it was how Gavin introduced me, that he said, I want to make a play about how meaningless middle-aged white Western men are, and you're the most meaningless man I know. May I use your life? So I'm kind of used to it. But for Mespel in the Dark, for the film version, again, it is absolutely my flat and it's me, but it's not really me. And bits of it you go, oh God, that's very depressing. That is what I seem to be like, you know.
But hold off now a wee minute. I will come back to Mespel in the Dark live. But I never got to talk to you about that. Everyone is King Lear in his own. And I remember saying, what is it like, actually, you know, because when an actor sees the set, you start getting used to, well, where's that chair? And how can I move over there? And those cups, they have funny handles on. When you were doing that,
Absolutely. I mean, they took all my books and all my stuff, and it was all my stuff that was on stage. So, yeah, it was extraordinary. And Judith is a very good buddy of mine. And we had a thing where I think we only ran for a week. And so we had a guest performer every night. And it would be just friends who would actually be in my
flat. Who would have been calling past.
Yeah. And so we did that every night. And it was, again, you're not trying to get into character, obviously, because you're probably there. It was very, very strange.
And were there aspects of the facsimile that were stranger than life itself in some ways?
Yeah, literally one day I woke up on stage. We were teching or I'm not sure what, and I fell asleep on the sofa on stage, and I was facing away from the auditorium, and I genuinely had to check whether I was at home or whether I was on stage. Yeah, yeah. It was very odd. Very, very odd.
Was there something about a shower?
There was a shower in that as well. But for the film version, nobody notices it except me. When you're having a shower by yourself, you don't clench your buttocks. But if you have a film crew in the shower with you, you do. So it's the one big flaw I notice in the Messville in the Dark is that during the shower, I'm clenching my bottom for some reason.
Things about acting that I never thought I would find out.
You can see them on the RT Culture site. They're all up there at the moment. So if you want to see Andrew's clenched bottom, go right ahead.
I might hang off on that for just a little while yet. So that was in the film version.
That was in the film version, yeah, yeah. Luckily, the audience will be spared any of that in Messing in the Dark live.
Because there's no film crew in the shower with you.
No, no, no. There's no shower.
Okay, there's no shower. Yeah. So now where do I go from here? So let us try to explain then. I said in the introduction, Gavin, that you know what we're finding out in, or what you're looking at here in some ways is what can theatre do that film can't do? Now, those of us who have a big love of theatre will say, of course, everything it can do and more, my dear. But, I mean, you are lucky because obviously film can do things that theatre can't do as well. You know, they're like both your children. You've got to love them equally, no matter whether they're a theatre or a film.
Yes, you have to love them equally, exactly. But I suppose when we're thinking about artistically or from a making a theatre show point of view, going back to basics. So what we've done is we've made a raised stage in the Beckett. That's interesting. We have the audience very close on three sides. We have a pantomime horse. We have smoke machines. We have dancing. We have singing. But that element of live performance and we have audience participation. So we've got this very unique kind of whip it up with the audience atmosphere. And so when you come to this show, it'll be, you know, it's not a kind of naturalistic drama. It's more like a kind of an event that happens in this room with these great characters. So I guess we're talking about like trying to make that aliveness, that sort of special connection that you can have in the theatre between the audience and the actors and feeling that kind of buzz on stage.
And the other side of it is, unlike the situation in the Everyone is King Lear in his own home, Andrew, the set here is quite abstract. There are no props and stuff hanging around you.
I think there's an armchair and I think there's a table with a few necessary props.
It's a bit like a rehearsal room, is it?
Not unlike. Now, it will all be made absolutely beautiful by Aidan Cosgrove's lighting and all of that kind of thing. But, it's absolutely bare. And I think a thing that has to be mentioned is Bob O'Mahony's central performance. And it is the central performance. Mm. And I think in lots of ways, Messville in the Dark Live is sort of about theatre, about a life spent in theatre, which Bob has done. And he has this kind of fascinating way of performing. He's this like really visceral, sort of dirty actor. It's like every word is an action, you know. It's like a punch, so that's like the sweat and all sorts of liquids flying across the stage. So when an audience sits into that, they're aware. It's kind of like being at, you know, a boxing match or something. It's absolutely happening here and now, and Bob is excellent in it. He's really knocking it out of the park.
What about the Messville Flats themselves then, which is the chosen location obviously for the films in the first place and the specifics of Andrew's Flats and others who live there? How arty a place was it? How arty a place is it?
Well, I mean, lots of friends of mine lived there in the last 10, 15 years and we'd always kind of hang out and meet and we'd talk about living in this complex. And I came across the fact there were lots of individual actors living there, artists, costume designers, people who worked in the theatre, and just that having that sort of grouping of people who worked in the arts in the one complex was just an anomaly, an interesting thing that happened. But, you know, in the old days, obviously around that area in Baggot Street, there were loads of visual artist studios that were there. Maybe not so much now in the future, but like it was a place where, you know, that has a sort of slightly bohemian feel to it. So I think because I remember hearing all these stories and collecting all these stories from, you know, Andrew and friends of his who lived there, I thought it would make a great idea for a project, you know, whether it be a film or a theatre show. But it's sort of, you know, it's a unique place.
And when you moved there, Andrew, was that part of the reason that you wanted to live in the place? I know it's very close to town, which is quite handy if you're working in theatre, obviously.
It's amazing. I think I'm right in saying that they're the first purpose-built flats in Ireland. There was a big house there, Messville House, and the old lady, when she sold it to whoever was building the flats, left a stipulation that they had to leave the trees. So we still have these fabulous trees. And all the houses are named after a tree. I live in Rowan House, there's Cherry House, there's Oak House. And there was always this sort of, I don't know, it was like a kind of village or a town in a tiny area. And still today, I mean, you know, there is a slight sense of it changing, but still it's a lovely place to live. I have fabulous neighbours, you know, all sorts of different types of people. I think it is becoming less bohemian, unfortunately, you know, with the way prices are in Dublin, all this kind of thing. But there's still, you know, there's life in the old dog yet, like, you know.
Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, drama's all about conflict. How much conflict is there between the various houses, between the various trees and the various branches of Mespel, of the Mespel building? Is that part of what's going on here?
Well, there's a conflict which is in the theatre show, which is about, you know, this conflict of how do you continue doing what you want to do, making theatre, making art, and then also make a living. So that conflict comes out in the theatre show, but it's also about the kind of difficulty of making theatre, the difficulty of making art, and you get a sense, especially with the main character, Bob, his character, Bill, has written this play he's trying to put on, and you get just the difficulty and the work that goes into it and the frustration, and also he goes through, you know, kind of decades of history around working in theatre, and we hear lots about rehearsal rooms, and we hear lots of great anecdotes about just trying to survive in this very strange, I guess, vocation that people call theatre. So yeah, that's where the conflict comes from, this creative conflict.
And that is an ongoing conflict. I mean, I'm laughing at the fact that your character, Andrew, is supposed to be this actor who only does voiceovers. I mean, voiceovers is a big... In fact, I read a review for a radio program just recently where you had narrated a documentary and the specifics of your voice was mentioned within it. It is a very difficult way to make a living.
It is a very difficult way to make a living. You're constantly, you know, worried about stuff. Some of us are luckier than others. Like, nobody's forcing you to do it. But the trouble is that once you've started doing it and you start getting into your 50s and 60s, you're going, well, I can't do anything else.
What's my skill set?
Yeah, I grew up on a farm. I wouldn't be able to dig a hole anymore. You know, there's lots of things I physically couldn't do now. So you are kind of stuck in it. I'm not saying I feel delighted with things.
I was going to say, you're stuck in it, but when you're stuck in it, and I know there are large inverted commas around that for you, you get to come across films like On Colleen Kuhn. If you didn't have the theatre background that you had, that film, which, I mean, I spoke to you at the time.
Yeah.
It is an extraordinary film.
Yeah.
Take out Irish language, take out Irish. It is an extraordinary film, full stop. What kind of reaction have you been getting to it?
All good. You know, people are always anybody who does stop you in the street is always very pleasant. Sometimes they become too serious about their own lives, and you're kind of going, oh.
But that must say something about the nature of the film itself.
Oh, no, totally.
If somebody's stopping you to tell you you're great in the film, and then suddenly they're
talking
opening
about themselves,
up with themselves.
Yeah. And you kind of, I just feel slightly embarrassed, and I'm not qualified to talk to people about, you know, serious issues in their lives, you know. But it is great that it's doing so well, and, you know, I heard recently that apparently it's the longest ever running film in the IFI and all of this kind of business, so.
Funny enough, I was in the IFI over the last couple of days, and I saw Colleen Kuhn was on, and I think it's three
bloody things.
Well, no, I just saw it, and I think it's still maybe I can't remember the exact number of showings a day, so I won't conjecture. I thought, wow, it's obviously still getting people
it's
in.
Absolutely great, yeah, it's wonderful, yeah.
And there must be a lot of buzz around the Oscar scenario.
Well, we're not nominated.
Yeah,
for
but you're going to. Let's hope.
It would be a nice Christmas you will be present. Put to get onto the long list would be a very nice Christmas present. And then after that, look, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, listen, congratulations once again. Where and when, I suppose I should tell people about Mespel in the Dark. So the live version will kind of pick up on what the. And people can still see the films online.
At the moment,
is that a good kind of. Is that a good thing to have seen before you go to see the theatre show?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, they're now available. They're actually available on the RT Culture page, the first four episodes. The next two episodes, which we made with Aidan Gillen and Alwyn Fuere and Bob Manny, they were going to be entering them into festivals. But the four that are available, they're available on that page. Yeah. And the show itself then is six shows only, and it's the 5th to the 10th. So it's Monday to Saturday at 7:30. It's about an hour long. It's extremely entertaining and funny, and as I say, it's worth. The cast are great: Pauline Nutton, Kareem Tamu, Andrew, and but it's great to see Bob Manny. It's a virtuoso performance. I'd recommend lots of actors to come and see it because it's really amazing to see him on stage.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's Mespel in the Dark live previewing, as Gavin told us there, from Monday the 5th of September. Opens then on Tuesday, running through until Saturday the 10th. So you have to be quick. It'll be over before you know it. So go and check out the website, pampantheatre.com. And of course, you can also check out those films on the RTE Culture page. Gavin Quinn, Andrew Bennett, Oscar nominated film, I hope. good to see you both. Thanks you for too, coming sir. In. But that was all about the merging of several types of music and classical music. Well, the merging of jazz and classical music has a long and illustrious history, going back to George Gershwin, I suppose, his iconic Rhapsody in Blue. Lines between the two genres consistently tested and blurred by people like Leonard Bernstein, Wynton Marsalis, several others over the years. Well, this Wednesday evening in the McLally Theatre in Galway, audiences will have a chance to experience another such fusion in the company of Contempo Quartet and four of Galway's best jazz musicians. Jazz Tempo is the title of the project. It's been developed by Galway Music Residency in partnership with composer Matthew Beryl, who joins me now from our Galway studio. Matthew, before we get stuck into the music itself, they're all music. How different in terms of the discipline, the style, the way of playing that's involved, how different are jazz and classical music? And I know you could write a PhD thesis on that, but maybe you'd give me the radio answer, which is about a minute long.
Absolutely. Well, I guess, they're both similar in many ways, but one of the main things, I guess, would be improvisation and playing music that isn't necessarily written down. That would be in the jazz world. So you'd be working off themes and forms that are agreed upon, like the blues. So improv and like off the cuff improvisation in groups, I guess that's the main difference. But that, of course, would have happened in classical music in the 15th and 16th century and early music. And then it began to be written down and sort of, yeah.
I suppose, in some ways, if you go back to Baroque music, the soloists there were often given nothing more than a series of chords, a chord chart, like a jazz player would be given, and the person who's playing the melody instrument, in the case of a jazz, you could be talking about saxophone or something like that, the person playing the solo improvised knowing what the shape of the piece was in terms of the chords.
Indeed. So there are many similarities, I guess, for sure. Yeah.
So are you mixing both improvisation and dots on the page for this concert of yours?
We are indeed, yeah. So a combination of written down composed material and improvisation sections, which are based upon the melody or the chord sequence that have gone before them. And we're actually drawing from a few jazz standards. So we're playing like four pieces that I've arranged that aren't my compositions, like Bluesette by great harmonica player Toots Thielemans, and some pieces by Duke Ellington and Dizzy Gillespie. So like some classic pieces that have been arranged specifically for this ensemble. And then there's four of my own compositions.
Yeah,
so a nice mix.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, I'll come to the specifics of the mix of the jazz, I suppose, players and the contemporary quartet. But your own background then, is it very much in both camps, both the classical and the jazz camps?
Yeah, most definitely. I guess I grew up initially playing a lot of traditional Irish folk music on violin and guitar and surrounded by all that brilliant world in Galway. And as I grew up, I played more classical music and delved into orchestral playing and chamber music playing. So I've really, really fond memories from that from my teens and 20s. Yeah, and then so I guess jazz excited me, and the fact that things aren't always the same each time, so that I pursued that, I guess.
Tell me a little bit about it. I'm going to listen to one of your pieces first of all. This is a recording of a piece called Jambo. Tell me about Jambo.
Jambo is a piece I wrote actually after a visit to Kenya where I played some music with my sister, Naomi Beryl. And that was the way they greeted everyone, Jambo, to say hello. And that was just a starting point for this sort of fun piece. So I recorded this with a group called Cortisol a while back now with some good friends from Dublin and Wicklow.
And that's Matthew Beryl and a little bit of his piece called Jambo, a way of saying hello. In Kenya, was that the country that you said to me,
Matthew? Yeah, that's right. So. Yeah, we ended up there for some St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, well, jambo to all our Kenyan listeners then on this Monday evening. However, what you're doing as part of this concert and as part of this project, Jazz Tempo, is mixing the contemporary quartet, wonderful classical music quartet, and then four jazz players. What is the overall instrumentation? Obviously, the string quartet has the two violins, the viola and the cello. How have you added to that, Matthew?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's myself, I play clarinet and saxophone, and then good friends, Angus Hackett, who's a stalwart of the Galway jazz scene, who's a super guitarist and composer himself, vocalist Roisin Moulier, and a great bass player, Barry Donoghue, who was also actually telling us recently that he's a star. He used to be a star golfer in the day that McIlroy won. But yeah, we're all Galway. We're from Galway, and I guess that sort of brought us together, and we've played a lot over the years in places like the Black Gate and Campbell's Tavern out in Clonover outside Headford, and I guess we it was just, the idea was to bring what we do and partner it up with what the contempo quartet do and learn from each other, I guess.
Yeah, and there is a kind of something new comes out of all of that. I'm going to listen to an excerpt. This is from an online event that you did. It's a YouTube link, so obviously it's just a YouTube recording that we're getting here, but it gives us a sense of how the string quartet and the jazz instruments mixed together. A piece called Flippy Floppy. The idea behind this one, Matthew.
Yeah, that's actually a phrase that my brother-in-law, Alessandro, uses a lot. You know, things can be flippy-floppy. You know, sometimes they can be good, sometimes they can be bad, and it just stuck. Yeah. It's a fun piece, and I guess it's influenced sort of by Brazilian music, by samba music, the underlying beat.
Yeah, I had a sense of that. And it's you, we're going into a little extract in the middle, and it's you on clarinet here. A bit of a clarinet solo, essentially. Little section there from a piece called Flippy Floppy, a composition from Matthew Beryl, who's part of the Jazz Tempo octet, I suppose we refer to it as, Matthew, that will be performing at the McLally Theatre in Galway on this coming Wednesday. In fact, you mentioned Alessandro there. Now, I could have my names mixed up here. Is Alessandro one of the members of the Contempo Quartet?
No, he's not. He's Alessandro Colombo. He's my sister's husband from Italy. Right. But yeah, there's Andrea and Adrian and Ingrid and Bogdan. And I guess, yeah, they've been ingrained in the musical and social culture of Galway for over 20 years now, I think. And it's actually just such a pleasure to rehearse and play and learn from them and with them, and they're so open. They've been so open to this project, which is a joy.
Yeah, well, they have that quality in their own playing. No matter what the music they're playing is, they seem to have an openness to all sorts of influences. But I was struck listening to your own piece there, Flippy Floppy. Maybe it's because of the presence of the strings. I kept hearing something like the sound of Aitor Villa-Lobos, you know, he's Brazilian, isn't he, composer? And he does that. He has that great piece, Bacchianus Brasileiros, where he has the cellos, the strings and voice, which has that mixture of, I suppose, samba and Bach, for want of a better idea. What have you found that the string quartet in particular, I suppose in the arrangements that you've made for the jazz standards, what has it brought to that surprised you?
Well, I guess just their, like, the sense of playing with an ensemble. I've been together for so long. I have really learned from that, and just the sense of togetherness and willingness to, I guess, go wherever the music is going. And of course that happens in jazz and improvised music and classical music, but yeah, just their sense of togetherness, but also their openness and willingness to like debate what way things should go, should they go this way or that way, and there's not always a correct way, so it comes together through conversation, and we've been doing that even just by chatting about the blues, and how long is the blues form, is it 12 bars, it could be more, it should, you know, so we've had lots of fun just teasing out things.
Yeah, and I suppose it's the teasing out is where the fun is. Any plans beyond then? Because I'd love to get a chance to hear them, to hear you guys along the way somewhere.
Indeed, yeah. Well, this sold out very quickly, and we looked into maybe putting on a second performance, but it wasn't technically possible. But yeah, we are in talks with the Galway International Arts Festival for a possible performance next summer.
Right. Well,
the Galway Music Residency's 20th anniversary, so they're an integral part of this production.
We will watch out for that. Thanks for being with us this evening, Matthew.
Thanks so much.
And coming into our Galway studio. Thanks to our colleagues in Galway for that. Speaking to me about Jazz Tempo, a project which blends classical and jazz music, performed in a 60-minute performance Wednesday, the August the 31st at the McLally Theatre in Druid Lane in Galway, which is sold out. No, the McLally Theatre, yes, in Druid Lane in Galway, sold out, but hopefully there'll be other chances. Druid.ie for full details on that.